film of Palestine. Undoubtedly, the dream of Israel was born for the first time in this movie with the magic of cinema, and it moved before the greedy eyes of the Zionists. The First World War was devouring and ravaging the world like a monster, but the Zionists were lurking so they might be able to find some booty for themselves from the heart of all the destruction. When the war fronts were tied, the World Zionist Congress made a stunning proposal to the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George. If Britain undertakes to support the Jewish immigration to Palestine, they will enter the United States into the war. Soon that the Germans, who were supporters of the Ottoman Empire, by sinking the ships belonging to Zionist merchants, forced the U.S. President Woodrow Wilson to enter the battle. A year later, when Allies were at the gates of Al-Quds, Yaakov Ben Dov, a Jewish immigrant who had founded the Menorah Film Company, shot his first film. The movie depicts the historic arrival of General Allenby, the commander of the British Army, in Al-Quds on December 11, 1917. With the arrival of the Allies in Al-Quds, the 400-year-old reign of the Ottoman Empire on the city ended. Palestine came under the tutelage of Britain, and the Zionist dream finally came true. Only a month before the arrival of the Allies, a statement was issued in which Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, announced England's support for establishing a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. In the declaration, which became known as Balfour, London pledged it will provide the necessary means for Jews' immigration to Palestine on the condition the newly arrived Jews are employed in lands that are not owned by any individual. The declaration was a beginning of efforts in the international arena to establish a so-called State of Israel. It is not an exaggeration if we say that the conditions of the Balfour Declaration became the manifesto of the Israeli cinema. Ben Dov, who is dubbed as a father of the Israeli cinema, in collaboration with several other filmmakers in a project called Mirror of the Return of the Israeli People, immediately started making propaganda documentary films. Many of the films were ordered by the Jewish National Fund, an organization that was established in 1901 with the aim of buying land from Palestinians and, in a broader perspective, for the development of Jewish lands in Palestine. These movies also depicted the Arabs of Palestine in the form of primitive people, serfs, and without any national identity, who were wandering about in the desolate and barren desert. The model of the narrative structure of what later became known as the Israeli cinema is the product of that period. This structure narrated history like this. Jewish immigrants took root in an inhabited and abandoned territory, expanded it, and made it prosperous. Movies that announced the discovery of a lost paradise that had no owners. Hence, moviegoers all around the world watched the story of the Zionists like a big luck for the Palestinians. The migration that brought culture and wealth to the quote-unquote miserable land. On the other side of the world, Jewish capitalists who were fleeing the war and had entered the U.S. a little earlier and founded Hollywood started making films from the very first days that completed the narrative of the Zionist cinema. Legendary Hollywood producers, the Warner Brothers, Samuel Goldwyn, and Louis Mayer presented a fixed and dangerous stereotype of the hated Arabs in their movies. Wild and backward people who soon became the most infamous characters of Hollywood. With the help of the silver screen, the image of the confrontation between educated Jewish immigrants and primitive Arab inhabitants occupied the historical memory of moviegoers all over the world. In the Middle East, Arabs, like many Eastern societies, got to know cinema from the 1920s. In the 1930s, cinema halls were established in all major cities of Palestine. But the way cinema entered the Palestinian society turned into a big issue. Most of the movies that were shown on the silver screens were Egyptian musical comedies. Superficial melodramas that exposed private romantic relationships to the public for the first time. Religious figures, not only in Palestine, but also in Syria, Egypt, and Jordan, constantly asked the authorities to stop the movies or at least censor them. Despite all of this, the cinema seemed insignificant compared to the great problems that Palestinians were dealing with. 10 years had passed since Palestine was Britain's tutelage. At the turn of the 1930s, an influx of Jewish migrants started from everywhere in the world towards Palestine, and the Arabs were slowly realizing that they were being trapped. It was during that period when Palestinian protests in the cities of Al-Quds and Jaffa turned bloody and the British army suppressed the Arab uprisings. Arab leaders showed up claiming they want to resolve the problem of the Palestinian people, but their presence was so ineffective that it was unclear whether they were going there to protect Al-Quds or to say goodbye to it. In 1935, Saudi King Abdulaziz bin Saud went to Al-Quds. The only thing that made this trip different was the presence of a Palestinian with his camera, Ibrahim Hassan Sarhan. Sarhan made a 20-minute movie of the event and started the Palestinian cinema. At that time, Sarhan and a few other passionate filmmakers experienced making movies again, a cinema that has no trace today except for the memories of the people and the notes printed in the newspapers back then. It looked like Palestinian cinema was being shaped, but the storm of events that soon reached Palestine shattered the dreams of the first generation of Palestinian filmmakers. The situation in Palestine worsened with the start of the Second World War. The the Zionists were moving Jews from Eastern Europe and America to Palestine in droves. By the end of the war, the Jewish population had increased from 5% at the beginning of the 20th century to 30%. The increase in population coincided with the decline of Britain, which had suffered a huge loss in the heart of the war front. Britain, that once claimed that the sun never sets on the territory of its empire, turned into a toothless lion at the end of the war that was not even capable of protecting its smallest and closest colonies. Now, the maintenance of Palestine required at least 100,000 soldiers.
Part 1A.
The bankrupt and weak British Parliament immediately left the issue of Palestine to the United Nations.
I now declare open the first meeting of the United Nations Palestine Commission.
In 1947, the partition plan of Palestine was approved by the United Nations, and Palestine was divided between the Arabs and the Jews. But it was decided that the Zionists would not have the right to form any government before British forces leave Palestine. It was the golden opportunity the Zionists had been looking for years. From that time on, the Zionist terrorist groups drove the final nail in the coffin of the British Empire with numerous bombings and attacks on British soldiers. May 14, 1948, the last British ship had not faded away yet when Ben-Gurion announced the existence of Israel in a speech broadcasted by the media.
From the Jewish homeland, Palestine, and the Jewish Brigade.
The skirmish started. Israel occupied Haifa, and pretty soon the cities of Safa and Acre fell. After the bombardment of Jaffa, Sarhan and his friends left all their movies and videos among the blood and fire and ran away. Finally, on May 15, 1948, Israel attacked Al-Quds. On the same day, the Arab armies entered Palestine. Despite the initial victories, the Arabs eventually retreated on all fronts. With the loss of more lands, the number of displaced persons increased by the day. Finally, after a year of conflict, in May of 1949, the Arab countries that rushed to the rescue of the Palestinians surrendered one after the other. The countries inevitably signed the ceasefire agreement. The signing of the agreements paved the way for the acceptance of the usurped government in the United Nations. When the life of the Palestinian community as a political and social entity came to an end, an absolute silence prevailed, a silence of anger and guilty conscience. Life in the coastal cities almost disappeared, and half of the Palestinian citizens became homeless and refugees. about 900,000 displaced people. For years, the refugee ideology dominated the Palestinian culture. Refugees are always pulled here and there, but remain in a temporary state. Memory and nostalgia are a way to understand the history of Palestine, a repressed memory that moves to the subconscious mind like a mental injury and disrupts the sequence of time. The past replaces the present, and the future finds meaning only in the form of a return to the past, a history that endlessly repeats the past that resembles paradise and its collapse. While the Palestinians were shackled with silence, the new storytellers of the Arab world emerged from Egypt. A group known as the Free Officers stage a coup against King Farouk of Egypt. Mohamed Naguib was in the forefront, but everyone knew that the mastermind was none other than Gamal Abdel Nasser, a person who quickly managed to reach the presidency. In a brave move, Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal. The decree had far-reaching and dramatic consequences. Since 1948, Western countries sought to bolster the Israeli regime, and the Suez Canal witnessed the daily traffic of foreign ships and arms aid to the Israelis. Although there were other reasons behind the decree by Nasser, it had many untold stories for the Palestinians. The first dramatic consequence of the brave move happened 3 months later. On October 29th, Israel attacked Egypt and occupied the Sinai Peninsula with the help of French and British forces. The Soviet Union supported Nasser and entered the Egyptian battlefield and stood up against France and England. Finally, Britain and France signed a peace agreement and the Israeli soldiers had to retreat. Thus, Nasser reached the peak of his popularity. He spread his story all over the Arab world. The story of the United Arab Ummah, or nation. For many years, the Arabs had pinned their hopes on Gamal Abdel Nasser, but perhaps most of all, the Palestinian refugees were hopeful about Nasser. The dream of a united Arab nation was meaningless without the freedom of Palestine.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
مشکلات ما تو ملکوت و جبروت نیست، خیلی از مشکلات ما جلو پامونه، اینا گره میندازه تو زندگیمون.
Our problems in this world are not rooted in something heavenly or otherworldly. Once, Ayatollah Hasanzadeh Amoli, the famous Iranian scholar and mystic, may Allah protect him, told me a story about himself. He said, in the past, during the summers, the Islamic seminaries of Qom were off, and I used to travel to my village, that is Larijan in northern Iran. I hold my classes over there in the village, and my students also traveled from the city of Qom to that village to continue their studies. Now, my routine daily work was to hold one or two classes during the morning, then say my salat at noon, have lunch, and then take a rest in the noon. During nights, I also had a speech for public in the mosque.
فرمودن که من یه مرتبه وقتی بعد از نماز ظهر نهار خوردم خواستم بخوابم، بچه‌ها تو خونه داشتن بازی می‌کردن، شلوغ پلوغ.
Once when I was taking a short nap during the noon, the children were playing in the yard and were making lots of noise. I got a little angry and criticized them for the noise. Then I decided to continue my rest. However, I found that I cannot rest because I was not happy with my own behavior towards the children in the yard. I went out to the confectionery and bought a box of sweets and took to the house to give it to the children. I still was not satisfied with myself because I broke the hearts of the children in the yard. Now, from this story of Ayatollah Hasanzadeh Amali, we understand that many of our problems in this world are rooted in our own behaviors and deeds. That's why we may not grow spiritually unless we become perfect in every aspect and we take care of even minor affairs in our life, even inside our house. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page.
We'll leave you in our last care and goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey has found that the number of American households reporting tumbling incomes is growing. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the number of U.S. adults with declining incomes has soared in recent weeks in a sign of a weakening labor market. And that was according to a Bloomberg report. Bloomberg added, the share of households facing a drop in their incomes rose from 10.7% in August to 11.8% last month. Citing a survey of the U.S. labor market by data intelligence company Morning Consult, the increase was mainly driven by high and middle income families and the West region of the United States. About 20% of adults polled who earn $100,000 or more annually reported that they expected their incomes to drop in the next 4 weeks. RT added, the share of employees who reported working over 35 hours fell to 46.7%, representing a 12% drop from September 2022. The decline marked the lowest level since the spring of 2021, signaling a slowdown in U.S. business activity, the survey revealed. The most cited reason by respondents was soft business conditions. This comes as U.S. inflation-adjusted household income fell by the most in 12 years in 2022, highlighting the toll of a higher cost of living and the expiration of pandemic-era programs. The Income and Poverty Data released by the U.S. Census last month showed how deeply the U.S. economic conditions were affected by the COVID-19 crisis and the government's response to it. The measure of child poverty more than doubled following the expiry of pandemic-era child tax credits last year amid the worst inflation in 40 years, which has undermined household spending power. In another report, RT wrote, as Uncle Sam continues to pump billions of dollars into Kiev's flagging fight against Russia and provide tempting handouts to illegal migrants, why is the average American worker forced to live paycheck to paycheck? Here's a question that most people have considered at least once in their lives and probably a lot recently. How much annual income would you need to feel financially secure? For the average American, the magic number comes out to be $233,000 a year, according to a survey by Bankrate. To bring the 99% back down to earth, the U.S. Census Bureau released some sobering data that dashed those elusive six-digit dreams. Inflation-adjusted median household income fell to $74,580 in 2022. A 2,300 decline from 2021 average of $76,330. This marks the third straight annual decrease since the COVID-19 pandemic began in 2020, taking a wrecking ball to the heart of the economy. The bad news doesn't end there for U.S. consumers, who are now struggling with the consequences of a foreign conflict in a distant land and a wide-open border. Those factors have prompted the cost of living to surge higher than it has in over four decades amid runaway inflation. In June 2022, the year-over-year inflation rate, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, hit a jaw-dropping 9.1%, the highest it has been since the administration of former President Ronald Reagan. A significant reason for the increase in inflation happened on March 3, 2022, when President Joe Biden signed an executive order to ban the import of Russian oil, liquefied natural gas, and coal to the U.S. This decision has had disastrous results for the local economy. Since Biden's inauguration, the cost of gasoline alone had jumped at one point by 100%. As of September 27th, the average price of regular gas was $3.832 per gallon, according to the AAA, while gas prices were an average of $2.3 per gallon when Biden entered office, forcing just about everything else to skyrocket, including the number of poor people in the U.S. The poverty rate in the U.S. exploded last year, the first increase in 13 years, and that was according to the Census Bureau. In 2022, the rate was 12.4%, up 4.6 percentage points from 2021, according to the Supplemental Poverty Measure, SPM, a method for tallying government welfare programs and tax credits designed to assist low-income families. Meanwhile, the expectations index, determined by consumers' short-term outlook for income, business, and labor market conditions, sunk to 73.7 in September. That follows a drop to 83.3 in August. The worrisome part is that an expectation index below 80 generally indicates an impending recession. an economic tragedy is already quietly happening for millions of American consumers who are now living paycheck to paycheck precariously and who have been forced to use the payment method of last resort to make ends meet, the almighty credit card with its exorbitant interest fees. On this score, the U.S. economy has broken yet another record, although not in a way that could be considered something to cheer about. The Street reported U.S. credit card debt rose by $45 billion to $1.3 trillion in the second quarter from the first quarter, a 4.6% quarterly increase. The Street added, "It's the first time in U.S. history that household credit card balances topped $1 trillion mark as the number of credit card accounts expanded by 5.48 million to 578.35 million in the quarter. When consumer debt suddenly equals the amount the U.S. spends on its military-industrial complex, you know there is a problem." Clearly, the U.S. has some serious domestic issues that need to be resolved, but instead, it would rather fund a totally senseless proxy war against a nuclear power halfway around the world. Washington has given Ukraine close to $100 billion in aid, with more in the pipeline, since Moscow launched its operation in February 2022. The cash, however, has not only been used to fund Ukraine's military. Billions of dollars have subsidized participants of the Ukrainian economy, like farmers and small business owners, market players whose counterparts in the U.S. desperately need help too. A recent study conducted by the Council on Foreign Relations shows that more than $30 billion, around 40% of total U.S. aid to Ukraine as of July 31st, has been financial or humanitarian assistance that is not directly connected to military support. Military funding comes out to around $50 billion.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. My pleasure.
You're welcome. Well, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to wudu based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, we had a series of programs with you, Sheikh, pertaining to the idea and concept of wudu. And we have covered some of the jurisprudential laws regarding that. You know, in making a wudu, actually, there are two parts that we have to wipe, right?
Sure.
One of them is the head, and the other one is the cap. What is it meant by cap?
Well, the cap is the upper part of the feet.
Mm.
It is the part, the raised part of the feet, which should be included while wiping the feet. Now you should wipe your feet from the toes, from the tip of the toes, until the Kaaba or the that raised part. So according to religious scholars, it's even better to wipe, to include some more parts and pull your fingers up to the joint. You know, that very part of the feet which separates the feet from the leg. Yes.
Mm.
So what is necessary is to include the cab or the raised part of the feet.
Mm-hmm. I see. Just quite related to that, is it recommended, Sheikh Javid, for us Muslims actually to perform wudu by wiping the, from the tip of the toes, actually, to the calf, but to also include the lower surface of the toes that touches the ground while walking?
Well, there's nothing in the treatise or in the Risala of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei to indicate that it is, recommended. But when we look at the scholars, they, as out of precaution, they do include a little portion or a part of the bottom of the tip of the fingers,
mm-hmm.
To just make sure. And of course, we do understand that what is necessary, what is obligatory, is to to wipe your feet from the very toes, from the tip of the toes, mm-hmm. and up to the joint, up to the upper parts, or what you call it as calf. Mm-hmm. So that part of the feet should be included. So you wipe your feet from the tip of the toes, and if you include one toe, it's enough. You know, this there's a very important question which I was reminded of telling this.
I wanted to ask you too about the the toes. Like some people in fact cover like all of their toes.
Yes.
All right, on their feet. So is that correct, or only one toe is enough, as you said?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with covering all the toes. It's not a problem at all. But if you wipe on one of the toes, even if it is the smallest one, mm-hmm. again, it's enough.
Not the big ones.
Not the big ones. Okay, many people start with the big one. Okay, right. They cover, they wipe the big toe. Mm. But that's not necessary. You know, this makes a lot of makes the problem a little bit less when it comes to ladies who wear the nail polish.
Shastavit, some of the people, due to their medical condition, they have their feet mutilated, right? Mm-hmm. And they don't have normal or natural feet, or even some parts of their legs are, cut off. How should they go about their wudu when they're wiping?
They have nothing to do because they don't have any feet to wipe.
If they have fake feet, false
they,
feet.
They don't have to wipe on it because it's fake, okay? Okay, if there's a part of the foot left, for example, the toes are not there, mm. but a little part of the feet are there and the man stands on that part of the foot. So that part of the left part should be
wiped,
yes. And the mask should be done on it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Shastavit. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shachavid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to wudu based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, if someone who performs wudu opens and closes the faucet or the tap while washing their hands and face or faces with the intent of the wudu, of course, what's the law regarding this? Because they have to touch the tap or the faucet, all right? And yes, sometimes it's wet.
Yeah,
Right. So does it affect their wudu?
Of course it does. Because when you are done and when you have performed wudu, now you're ready to wipe your head and feet. So you shouldn't use that finger which you are going to use to wipe your head and feet to turn off the tap or the faucet. So if the faucet is wet and the wetness transfers to your finger, you are not going to use that finger to wipe your head, because you are using new water, fresh water, to wipe your forehead or your head. And therefore, you should use another finger or those fingers which did not come into contact with the faucet or with the wetness on the faucet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is
you
for
know,
sure.
People do this out of their fear of, let's say, not being extravagant. Not to, you know, misuse, for
that's
example,
good.
Water.
That's good. I'm
right?
not telling them, okay, the religious authorities are not telling them to turn off the faucet or not to turn off, okay? It is good to turn off because wasting water is not okay,
yes, exactly.
this time around. But, okay, they can use the smaller fingers or the index finger, one of the fingers, and then use the other fingers to wipe their heads,
mm-hmm.
okay? And, of course... keeping the tap on and letting the water going, you know, is not good.
Mm-hmm, I see. Is it possible, Sheikh Javi, to use water other than that of wudu for wiping? And is it necessary to wipe the head with the right hand and in an up-down direction?
When it comes to... Yeah, using water other than the water or the moisture which is present on your finger, of course you should use you should be very quick to use your wet finger to wipe your head and your toes. You should not give you know delay the wuzu parts because that wuzu should be done. Different acts of wuzu should be done in quick succession, you know. With no delay between one part and another part. And if, for example, your fingers happen to become dry with no moisture left on them, you can take moisture from your beard, okay, from your face, okay, and then wipe your head and feet. And I wonder, you know, a lot of people I see in my life, they, for example, wipe their head and then without going to wipe their feet, they just, you know, rub their face with the same hands,
mm.
thinking that it's okay, it's just normal to wipe your hair, your face. And after, you know, I'm talking about people who wipe their head
mm.
and then, you know, rub their face
right.
before wiping their feet.
Yes.
Thinking that it's okay, it's the water of wudu and there's no problem, but that's a problem, you know.
Mm.
The person, without touching his hair, his face and other parts of his body,
yes.
should go down and perform the masa of feet. He should wipe the feet quickly without touching his face and arms.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz. For Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
headlines this hour. The UN agency says only one hospital is not functioning in the northern part of the besieged Gaza Strip as Israel presses ahead with its attacks on the Al-Shifa hospital. U.S. police attack pro-Palestinian protesters rallying outside of the Democratic National Headquarters in Washington, making a number of arrests. And resistance movement Hezbollah has